This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. I'm Sean Tubbs. It's Thomas Jefferson's birthday again, which means the Center for the Protection of Free Expression that bears his name is handing out its annual muzzles to groups that have somehow curtailed free expression in the last year. You can take a look at these now by visiting the center's website at tjcenter.org. I stopped by the offices of Center Director Robert O'Neill to get more details on this year's batch. Well, it's Thomas Jefferson's birthday again, and that means it's time for the Thomas Jefferson Center's Muzzle Awards. And I'm here with Robert O'Neill, the director of the center. Is there a theme that goes through this year?
In the sense that each year is different, there are some recurrent themes this year. For example, once again, we have several muzzles dealing with national security. We have, as has been the case every year, several that involve secondary school administrators, superintendents, and principals. And we have a couple that reflect good motives gone awry. Maybe to start with the national security area, we cite Representative Pete King, a usually rather moderate New York Republican, who, when he learned that the New York Times had done it again, a second round of revelations about clandestine surveillance programs conducted by the federal government, insisted that the Attorney General initiate criminal proceedings against the New York Times, its reporters, editors, and publishers, he said, for what in his view was clearly unlawful activity. He then, the next day, had a letter written from Congress to the Attorney General demanding the same rather drastic action. What strikes us as most troubling is the notion that a prominent member of Congress immediately singles out a major daily newspaper for what he believes is criminal activity, as though he's been prosecutor, judge, and jury all in one, and calls upon the Attorney General to prosecute them at once for a law violation. Now, whether some law dealing with classified information might have been compromised under the circumstance, a fair question. But you don't do it by coming out the way he did and just essentially throwing the book at them.
Did the Attorney General follow suit?
Apparently not. Now, one may say the Attorney General had other things on his plate at that point, but there is no evidence that any criminal charges actually were filed against the Times, despite the demand of Representative King and several others to do so. The one other national security issue at the federal level involves a program by the Defense Department to gather lots of information and ultimately to intercept emails, typically involving rather small protest groups, peace groups, engaged in protesting against the war in Iraq and calling for protest and peace-related activities. It was not only the extent of the information that this program gathered, but the way it was kept on file long after it had become clear that these organizations did not pose any terrorist threat.
How long was the information kept on file, and what kind of information were they collecting?
It was quite detailed about communications among the leaders and members of this group, when, where, and how they would have an anti-war rally, let's say several of them on college and university campuses, so that these were campus-based peace groups. Most of them were fairly small and, you'd have to say, fairly innocuous. The kind of poster child is one called the Thomas Merton Society and Thomas Merton Center for Peace and Justice in Western Pennsylvania, which was really a group of retirees and some college and university faculty just essentially sat around and shared their views about what they thought was going wrong in Iraq and Afghanistan, and suddenly found themselves the subject of extensive surveillance. Lawsuits have been filed, federal civil rights suits, suggesting that this activity probably was unlawful. We are troubled both by the fact that all this information was collected and by the fact that it was kept on file well beyond the time when it should have been clear these groups pose no possible threat.
So in a situation like that, the issue then isn't necessarily that the Defense Department is investigating these groups. It is the storage?
It's the targeting of essentially innocuous organizations who did no more than organize and orchestrate anti-war rallies and gatherings. This year we also have our first national security issue at the state level. The Ohio General Assembly, the Ohio Legislature, just about a year ago, enacted the Ohio Patriot Act. It contained a provision which mercifully no other state seems to have followed. Every applicant for public employment anywhere in the state of Ohio, including those who applied for teaching positions at Ohio State University and the dozen or so other Ohio public universities, would have to answer 6 questions. These are questions that asked about their political affiliations, asked whether they had ever solicited any individual for membership in an organization on the State Department's terrorist exclusion list, for example, and 5 other questions basically of that type. If one did not give a negative answer, refused to answer, or gave a positive answer, not only would that person forfeit the chance to get the job, but would quite likely be subject to investigation. This seems to us to smack dangerously of McCarthyism. These are kinds of questions that we haven't seen government asking in a half century. So we thought it was important to flag this, even though, as I said, mercifully no other state seems to have followed Ohio's example, because it is so ominously reminiscent of things we thought had been left behind a half century ago.
This year there are several, again, that deal with education and at the secondary school, and this year at the collegiate level as well. Could you take us through some of those?
Well, at the college level, the one that's most troubling is the National Collegiate Athletic Association, which about 2 years ago, for the best of motives, launched a campaign to reduce and in some cases forbid the use of Native American imagery, logos, and names. Had it been a flat ban on all such nomenclature and imagery, it would have been one matter. But the way it's played out, some institutions get a pass. Florida State University, for example, has come to terms with Seminole tribes, and they're allowed to continue their imagery and their naming. On the other hand, take the University of Illinois. They, at the end of the men's basketball season, essentially retired Chief Illiniwek because there is no real Chief Illiniwek. There's no tribe to which they could have gone to get a comparable kind of permission or blessing. The one that troubles us most is close to home, our sister institution, the College of William and Mary, which last year was told that they could continue to call their athletic teams the Tribe, but could not continue to use 2 crossed generic eagle feathers as their logo. Think of how the College of William and Mary's athletic department might possibly get some tribe's blessing to use these generic eagle feathers as a symbol. There's also something illogical about being told, well, you can call your teams the Tribe if you want, but you can't display eagle feathers because that would be demeaning or offensive or insulting to Native Americans.
What criteria was the NCAA trying to come up with? Was there a particular image that they were trying to do away with?
No, the language is very general. It simply prohibits displaying hostile or abusive racial, ethnic, national origin mascots, nicknames, or imagery. Now, why the eagle feathers are hostile or abusive, where the name the Tribe is not, is unclear. And it's not only Florida State that's gotten a pass. The University of Utah, Central Michigan University flags their teams as the Chippewas. They've also apparently come to terms. University of North Dakota, on the other hand, is already in federal court challenging the NCAA's ban on their use of the Fighting Sioux nickname.
If there was just an outright ban, do you think that the center would see to award the NCAA a muzzle?
It would have been a very different question, and it would have depended on how strong the rationale for imposing such a limit, the consistency and clarity of its application, all questions that are sadly not presented by this kind of patchwork policy with which we're currently dealing.
A common thread through the muzzles each year seems to be newspapers and high schools, and that seems to have come up again this year.
This year we have three high school, well, we'll say publications. One actually is a poetry magazine. The other two are newspapers, although the content that's troubling has also turned out to be rather different. In one case, it's an editorial attacking the school administration. In another case, it's an editorial actually attacking the school football team after an unusually bad season. In each case, the administration comes down very hard and, to us, sends exactly the wrong signal, not only to the student editors, who are the immediate target of such reprisals, but to the entire student body. At the very time when students ought to be learning their rights and responsibilities as citizens, the school administration could certainly fault them for taking on these issues in the way in which they did, but either suppressing the paper or imposing some sanction on the editors, that seems to us highly reprehensible and is also genuinely counterproductive in terms of the educational values and goals to which secondary schools should be committed.
The principal of Cincinnati's Princeton High School wrote the Thomas Jefferson Center a letter saying that, and I quote, "I believe that school newspapers are not a forum to bash anyone in the school without an opportunity for that person or group to have an equal opportunity to express the opposing side." And this is the important part, I think, here. "School newspapers are also not a forum to cause division within a school." Now, doesn't a school or the school administration have the right to censor a newspaper?
Under current Supreme Court case law, there is certainly an argument that school administrators may exercise a good deal of content control. We usually make clear, and in this case it's especially important, that we're not necessarily citing people for specific violations of the First Amendment. And indeed, some of our muzzles are followed by court decisions that seem to come to a contrary conclusion. So it is entirely possible that one or even all three of these administrators might be vindicated in a court proceeding. That doesn't, in our view, undermine in any way the inappropriateness of the lesson that is being sent, the way in which student editors and student readers, as part of this learning community, are taught exactly the wrong message. So technically, this is by no means the only time when a person who receives a muzzle might say, well, this is my legal right, or I think I would prevail in court. And our answer is, that may be true. We're not judges. We're not a jury. We're simply bringing to light our concern about sending an improper message, teaching the wrong lesson to young people who are feeling their way into adulthood.
On the same topic, in Knightstown, Indiana, the school board there also censored, but this time it was the school board there tried to stop the school board there took action when a movie that was deemed to be provocative was distributed on MySpace. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
It was a video creatively produced by four high school students on their own time and their own facilities, which showed a group of teddy bears attacking a teacher, and the teacher's name happened to be the same as a real teacher in that school. The real teacher learned about it. The administration decided that this was a threat to that teacher and thus first suspended, later actually expelled these four students. They went to court, and in December of last year, a federal district judge ruled on a preliminary motion in the students' favor that the school had gone way too far in suspending and then expelling them for having produced this video on their own time. Well, at that point, the students were reinstated. but much damage had been done in the interim. Since my wife is a secondary school teacher, and she reminds me periodically that the climate in which high school teachers operate these days can be rather troubling, even fearsome, schools properly take steps to protect their teachers. But the idea that in order to protect a teacher whose name is simply used in an off-campus video involving a bunch of teddy bears, that seems to us going way beyond the appropriate role of school administrators in protecting their teachers from genuine threats.
This is something that comes up in other situations and other roles, including locally here in Albemarle County recently. I've also heard in other schools, a friend of mine's daughter, 11-year-old daughter, was expelled from, well, was suspended from school for writing a list of people she just didn't like. Obviously, the center doesn't take a position on this vague issue, but can you just speak to the climate that we are in, and I guess the role of free expression or the protection of free expression in this kind of climate?
This is often described as zero tolerance. Zero tolerance, it seems to me, is a product not of September 11th or terrorist activity. It's a product of Columbine and other events in schools. And in order to prevent the recurrence of Columbine-like incidents, schools have tended to react, I think we would say overreact, by suppressing student speech, which may be troubling, but by going overboard in an attempt to maintain a safe and welcome environment within the school community.
Also in the school system, the Miami-Dade County, Florida School Board got into trouble for removing some picture books that somebody didn't think were giving the correct picture of Cuba.
The elementary and middle schools in Miami-Dade County had bought copies of 24 books, each of which described a visit to some country. Representatives of the politically powerful Cuban-American community in South Florida looked at the one that dealt with Cuba, a visit to Cuba, and they said this presents much too favorable a view of Cuba under Castro. It must go. The principal and the superintendent insisted that it should stay, but the school board reversed that judgment and insisted on the removal not only of a visit to Cuba, but of the other 23 books in that same series, even though no fault had been found with any of the books other than the one dealing with Cuba. That is an extreme overreaction to, admittedly, a politically powerful constituency in that community.
We also have another muzzle being given to the Watson Chapel School District in Arkansas. This is not about a publication, but it's about another kind of expression, clothing.
A group of students who were aggrieved by a new, unduly restrictive dress code came to school one day wearing black armbands. Two things about black armbands. The new dress code said nothing about wearing armbands. On the contrary, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Tinker case in 1969 had found the wearing of black armbands as an act of protest. That happened to be about the Vietnam War, to be a constitutionally protected First Amendment right of high school students unless it caused actual and substantial disruption of school activities. In this case, there was no claim of actual disruption, and as I mentioned, the new policy, the dress code, didn't even mention armbands. So the idea of suspending these students for the peaceful wearing of black armbands to school sounds as though at least one school board never got the message of a major Supreme Court decision of some 38 years ago.
This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. I'm talking with Robert O'Neill, the director of the Center for the Protection of Free Expression, about the Jefferson muzzles. One muzzle that could fall under the category of good intentions gone awry is one handed out to the Philadelphia Human Relations Commission.
Well, the Philly cheesesteak is certainly fun. There's a very popular restaurant in South Philadelphia, the owner of which had become increasingly displeased by the growing number of Mexican Americans in the area that he serves. So one day he posted over the order window in the restaurant a sign that says, "This is America. When ordering, speak English." The Philadelphia Human Rights Commission got word of this sign, and they issued a citation against Mr. Vento, the owner of the restaurant, for an act of discrimination in a place of public accommodation. There was no evidence that anyone had been denied service or was turned away or even was rudely spoken to when ordering a cheesesteak or anything else. This was simply a statement. Now, we'd have to say this is no way to enhance your business, no way to make friends among your neighbors in South Philadelphia or build a Hispanic clientele. On the other hand, to call this an act of discrimination that violates state law, or city law in this case, a city ordinance, seems to us an extreme overreaction. Mr. Vento has indicated no inclination to take down his sign, so the Human Rights Commission and the Philly Cheesesteak Restaurant are now on a collision course, all having to do with an expression of what seems to most people a kind of misguided, nativist, rather hostile sentiment. But that's his belief, and it's his place of business.
The chairman of the commission, the Reverend James Allen, has said the issue here is not that people have been denied service, but that people will be discouraged from carrying out a business transaction.
And that may well be the case, but in our view, discourage does not equate to discriminate.
Moving on to the state level, but also keeping, I guess, with the theme of free expression here, or in this case, I guess, the ability to read an unfiltered, uncensored thing, the administration of Kentucky Governor Ernie Fletcher has received a muzzle this year.
And in the case of the governor of Kentucky, he was having some serious legal problems. A blogger in Kentucky posted, or actually made, a comment to a New York Times reporter that was highly critical of Governor Fletcher and his administration. As soon as the administration picked this up, they blocked access by state employees at the workplace to a number of websites, apparently selecting those that had been critical of the governor and his administration, while leaving open and unfiltered access to, let's say, the Drudge Report, to Rush Limbaugh's website, to the Republican National Committee website, and others that were, suffice it to say, not critical of Governor Fletcher. That issue did go to federal court, and just a little over a week ago, in fact, the federal judge declined to dismiss the lawsuit, apparently ruling in favor of the blogger, Mr. Nicholas, who had filed the suit in federal court. So that one seems to be heading very much against Governor Fletcher, still at a preliminary stage, but the federal judge seemed persuaded of what appeared to us as selective or biased, viewpoint-biased filtering of access to various web sources.
So again, there, similar to one of the other cases that we've discussed here, it isn't necessarily the idea of putting this kind of prohibition in place. It's more of it's the selective use.
It is indeed, yes. If, for example, a state says you can't use state-owned or state-leased computers to do anything other than the business of the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Okay, that seems awfully drastic, but at least there's no viewpoint bias, there's no selectivity. Here, however, to say that you can't get bluegrassreport.org, but you can get the Drudge Report or the Republican National Committee website, that does seem selective.
Also at the state level, the Maine Bureau of Liquor Enforcement stepped in and also made a selective editorial decision regarding the name of a few beers.
Last year, this was done in Connecticut. Around the Christmas season, the Connecticut Alcoholic Beverage Commission forbade the use of the image of Santa Claus for Santa's butt beer. This year, it was the state of Maine. And what they did was essentially to crack down on a brewer, which a specialty brewer simply wanted to take advantage of the Christmas season with a creative logo, and the Maine Bureau of Liquor Enforcement said no go. This issue, in the view of the Maine State Attorney General, was indefensible. So they backed off, but not until after Christmas, too late to take advantage of the Christmas season, and that's part of what creates the problem for us. Obviously, under the 21st Amendment, which ended prohibition, states do have substantial power to regulate the sale and distribution of alcoholic beverages, but to do this on the ground that this particular advertising contained an undignified or improper illustration seems to us to go way too far.
And that's a case where they're stepping outside of their jurisdiction.
Well, it's not so much their jurisdiction, but they're certainly applying it in a draconian and, we would say, a form that is inimical even to commercial free speech, which enjoys a lower level of protection than pure speech.
Could you flesh that out a little bit about what is the distinction then between corporate speech and I guess, other kinds of speech?
Advertising has never been fully protected. For example, the advertising of an unlawful service or product has always been regulated differently from the advertising of a lawful product. False and deceptive advertising is also treated differently.
On this same topic, the Federal Communications Commission, I believe they got one last year, but they're getting one again this year.
Well, last year it was based on the new chairman's suggestion that the FCC ought to have the power to regulate content on satellite and direct broadcasting. This year it was an order entered just a little over a year ago that came down extremely hard on indecent and profane content, granting that obscenity, profanity, and indecency have since 1927 been treated differently from other content in licensed broadcasting. The order of a year ago went way, way beyond anything that we've seen anywhere else. So it targets for the first time non-indecent profanity, for example, incidental or inadvertent language that is alleged to be indecent, even after the commission had said that any use of the F word was presumptively sexual. This is going way beyond.
And one of the incidents that you cite there is simply it being the F word being displayed on a wall that a camera happened to catch, but it wasn't spoken, it wasn't uttered.
That's a prime example of exactly what we're concerned about, yes.
It seems that another issue this year in terms of control of the media is also goes back to the City Council of East St. Louis, Illinois, which signed a 15-year contract with a particular gentleman to operate the city's public access cable television station, but they weren't exactly happy with the content.
The operator of this public access channel had started a program called Talk of the City, and Talk of the City contained some unwelcome comments unfavorable to the city administration. So they simply pulled the plug. The cable system operator went to court and just a couple of weeks ago got a favorable decision from a judge in East St. Louis. It was a decision about the contract, the interpretation of the contract, and the contract term had something in it about discontinuance, but the city had not followed the contract provisions in the way in which they terminated. So the court said, we don't need to get into any First Amendment issues. It's enough that they did not follow the provisions of the contract.
Now, if it seems there that if the city had simply thought about the issue a little more and fleshed out some of these issues, they could have prevented a show like this. If they had said that you could simply show public events, but you can't necessarily have a public affairs program like this, it's not appropriate for our system. Would there have been a First Amendment issue then if they had carefully said this is not appropriate in this setting, this being a government channel?
The regulation of public access channels is exceedingly complex, but there might have been a way in which to do it. For example, a city, in the course of licensing a cable system, giving it a franchise, can require that they carry all city council proceedings, unedited, wall to wall, and so on. But pulling the plug because the system operator makes critical or unwelcome comments about city government, that is beyond the pale.
Given that the center has typically given muzzles to the president who was on duty at the moment, I believe President Clinton got at least two, did he?
Oh, yes, yes. Every administration, not only the president, but ranking cabinet officers, federal agencies, and so on, every year I think there's been at least one of those. And this year we cite the Bush administration for serious, systematic, and extensive suppression of scientifically valuable and truthful information about climate change, including but not limited to global warming. This has been a recurrent concern. Last year we gave a muzzle to a member of Congress for intruding in this area. This year we give it to the Bush administration because of evidence that has come to light rather recently. In fact, some of the strongest evidence has actually come to light in the early months of 2007. But there was ample evidence throughout 2006 of a focused, targeted campaign to suppress, either suppress or to change, to revise, to modify some of this information coming out of federal agencies and university laboratories with respect to climate change.
What is the exact First Amendment issue at stake here?
Again, it's not clear that there is a First Amendment issue. There certainly is an issue of free expression. And it's free expression not only on the part of the scientists whose reports have been changed or suppressed or modified or deferred, but also of the larger scientific community, which depends on the flow of accurate and credible information, and ultimately the interests, the expressive interests of the entire national population, which in turn depends on having access to this kind of timely and valuable information.
And the issue here, or at least one of the pieces of evidence that you have here, is that the former chief of staff of the White House Council on Environmental Quality made changes, actually went in and made specific changes to three government climate reports. Do you know what kind of changes he was making?
We don't have all the detail. We just know that such changes were acknowledged in very recent testimony. And as I'd mentioned, some of the strongest case for this muzzle actually has arisen in the last couple months into 2007, but it confirms a pattern that was well underway through last year.
It's another year, another set of muzzles, and I guess the work begins on next year's.
Oh, indeed. We're already collecting some candidates for next year from early January. We begin to discover and we get suggestions from others of what seem to be promising prospects for next year, although it'll be a year from now before we actually know what they will be.
Great. Well, Robert O'Neill, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
I'm delighted once again and look forward to another year.
You've been listening to an interview with Robert O'Neill, the director of the Center for the Protection of Free Expression, about the Jefferson muzzles. For a full listing of these dubious awards, visit tjcenter.org. I'm Sean Tubbs, and this is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, a public service of Wordcast Productions.